This is Randy Thompson sitting in for George Douglas. Welcome to the Triangle Radio Reading Services, The Week magazine, which offers the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's reading is from the issue dated June 29, 2012. The Triangle Radio Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. For the next hour, I shall be reading articles from these nine sections of The Week magazine, starting with the section called The Main Stories and running through these sections: Controversy of the Week, Good Week for, Bad Week for, People, Briefing, Best Columns in the U.S., The Last Word, and ending with the Talking Points section. But first, the main stories. The first of these main stories is titled A Military Power Grab in Egypt. What happened? An audacious power grab by the ruling military junta left Egypt in turmoil last week, as tens of thousands of Egyptians poured into Cairo's Tahrir Square to chant the name of the Islamist who they say won the presidential election. Muslim Brotherhood candidate Mohamed Morsi claimed to have won 52% of the vote in the first presidential race since the toppling 17 months ago of former dictator Hosni Mubarak. Morsi, a U.S.-educated engineer, promised to build a modern democratic state for all Egyptians, whether Muslim or not. But his rival, Ahmed Shafiq, Mubarak's last prime minister and a close ally of the generals, accused the Brotherhood of organized and persistent election fraud and declared that he had won the runoff. Whoever is eventually declared the winner will have little authority. The Supreme Constitutional Court, still mainly Mubarak's appointees, last week dissolved both houses of parliament, which the Brotherhood and other Islamists control. The junta then announced a new interim constitution that gives the generals the right to pass laws, control the budget, declare war, and steer the drafting of a permanent constitution. This is a military coup against the people, said Galal Osman, a protester in Tahrir Square. We want the president that we elected to have all the powers of his office. What the editorial said. Egypt's revolution looks increasingly like a mirage, said the Chicago Tribune, fearful that the Muslim Brotherhood would control both the presidency and the parliament. The generals gutted both institutions. Many ordinary Egyptians dislike the Islamic's religious dogma, but they fear a return to the dark days of Mubarak-style military rule even more. If the military won't ease its iron-fisted grip on power, there will be more mass protest and violence. Egypt was a big part of the Arab Spring, but it may be facing a long, hot summer. President Obama better get tough with the general, said the Washington Post. So far, the State Department has issued only gentle warnings about possible damage to Egyptian-American relations. We hope this message is being stated more bluntly in private. If the generals suffocate Egyptian democracy in the cradle, they should lose the $1.3 billion in U.S. military aid they receive every year. What the columnist said. This is a political masterstroke by the military, said Paul McGill in the Sydney Morning Herald. The generals knew they could lose their top dog status, wealth, and privileges if their man, Shafiq, lost and the Brotherhood controlled parliament too. Now the new president will be a figurehead at the same time. The junta has cleverly debased the judiciary by ordering it to dissolve parliament. So if anyone has a debate or grievance, where do they take it? Egyptians are starting to lose faith in democracy, said Tim Lister in CNN.com. Many have soured on the Brotherhood, which used its parliamentary majority to bolster its own power rather than help ordinary people struggling in a broken economy. With the revolution flailing and leaderless, the military saw the perfect opportunity to regain control. We should thank the generals for preventing a greater disaster, said Brett Stevens in the Wall Street Journal. The Muslim Brotherhood's allies in Parliament already sought to tighten Egypt's strict divorce laws and roll back a ban on female genital mutilation, thus erasing gains by women and secularists. If the Brotherhood were allowed to control the entire government, it would have been free to pursue the ultimate goal expressed by the group's de facto leader, Hayrat Deshatir, the Islamization of life. But what if this coup leads to civil war, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. When the Algerian military overturned an election victory by Islamists in 1992, the result was a horrific decade-long conflict in which some 200,000 people died. If the Nile Valley becomes a war zone, the violence could spill over into neighboring Israel and Gaza, further inflaming an already volatile region. That grim scenario makes a Muslim Brotherhood government in an uneasy alliance with the generals look like an attractive alternative. And the next main story is called Europe Spreading Crisis. The victory of a pro-bailout party in Greek elections this week eased fears that the country would have to exit the euro, but surging interest rates on Spanish and Italian debt signaled that the nearly three-year-old euro crisis is far from over. In Greece, the center-right New Democracy Party, which has vowed to keep the country in the eurozone, narrowly defeated the anti-austerity Syriza Party, prompting relief across global markets. But attention soon shifted to Italy and Spain, where the interest rates investors demand on government bonds spiked. In Spain's case, to a euro-era high. In response, European leaders are reportedly weighing whether to allow the European Union's bailout fund to buy hundreds of billions of dollars worth of Spanish and Italian bonds in an effort to drive down borrowing costs. Sorry if you thought the Greek election would be a turning point in this endless euro saga, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. Sure, if Syriza had been victorious, the consequences could have been catastrophic, with a likely Greek exit from the euro and contagion throughout Europe. This outcome buys Europe a bit more time, but brings the crisis no closer to resolution. The EU should use this brief respite to rethink its whole approach to the crisis, said Gideon Rockman in the Financial Times. It's clear now that the fate of the euro will be decided in Spain and, above all, Italy. It simply won't be possible to bail out two of the continent's biggest economies. So if European leaders aren't prepared to take dramatic steps towards banking, fiscal, and political union, they need to go backward and to return to national currencies. We're getting precipitously close to the moment when the situation in Spain and Italy becomes irretrievable. Yet Europe still seems unwilling to do what's necessary, said the New York Times in an editorial. There's no doubt that the relentless insistence on self-defeating austerity and piecemeal rescue plans led by Germany has only created more mistrust between countries and deepened their recessions. Europe now has another chance to take decisive steps to end this crisis, like issuing euro bonds or backing off mandated austerity measures. Will it? If the past 2 years are any guide, the likely answer is no. And that brings us to controversy of the week, immigration. Obama's surprising game changer. To quote Joe Biden, this is a big effing deal, said Nathan Pippinger in TNR.com. President Obama last week suddenly changed the terms of the nation's ongoing immigration debate by signing an executive order halting the deportation of between 800,000 and 1.2 million young illegal immigrants. Like the DREAM Act that was blocked by Senate Republicans in 2010, Obama's order effectively immediately lets immigrants under age 30 stay and work in the United States if they were brought to this country before the age of 16, have no criminal record, and have either graduated high school or served in the military. This order doesn't give young immigrants a path to citizenship, said Garance Frank Ruta in the Atlantic.com. The so-called Dreamers will have to reapply every 2 years to stay in the country. But for a whole generation of young people who are Americans in all but documents, Obama's order is the game changer they've been praying for. They no longer must live every day under the threat that they could suddenly be deported. Obama's executive overreach is unprecedented, said John Yoo in NationalReview.com. The Constitution requires the president to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, and the law is that those who entered the country illegally have to leave it. For Obama to refuse to enforce the law because he personally disagrees with it violates the very core of his constitutional duties. This decision reeks of political cynicism, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. After doing nothing to reform immigration for 3 years, Obama is trying to re-energize the disenchanted Hispanic voters he's counting on in November. He may yet regret that gamble, said Sean Trend in RealClearPolitics.com. It's more likely that Obama's unilateral dream order will wind up as a net negative for the president, with the exception of Florida, whose Cuban population is famously atypical of other Latino electorates. The only swing states with significant Latino populations are Colorado and Nevada. Tougher, together, those states are worth a mere 15 electoral votes. Obama's de facto amnesty could easily offset those gains by angering the independent working-class white voters with whom Obama is already struggling. Nonsense, said Andrew Sullivan in thedailybeast.com. Obama just pulled off a spectacular political coup. Hispanic voters are exhilarated and grateful. Polls show a stunning 64-30% margin of support among likely voters, and Willard Mitt Romney now has a huge dilemma. The Republican nominee became an immigration hardliner while pandering to the conservative base during the primaries, pledging his opposition to the Dream Act and saying he hoped to force illegals to self-deport. Lately, he's been trying to moderate that tone in hopes of winning some Hispanic votes. Obama, though, has now boxed him in. Romney must either support Obama's initiative, enraging conservatives, or oppose it, further alienating Latinos. No wonder he's ducking the question of whether he'll undo Obama's order if he's elected president. Well, we'll take a look at that, a frustrated Romney stammered. Romney's decision shouldn't be so complicated, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. The young immigrants who will be freed of fear by this order were utterly blameless, and anyone with a moral compass and a heart can see that. Romney, one suspects, would agree if he could. But Republicans have made a conscious decision to offer nativists and xenophobes a comfortable home. If that decision costs them the election in November, they will have no one to blame but themselves. And that brings us to Good Week 4, Bad Week 4. It was evidently a good week for moving to Sweden. After a new report indicated that the average Swedish work week hit a historic high, 26.2 hours, unions are complaining that the added work can affect people's health. And it was a good week for using your elbows. After a new study found that the two most germ-infested surfaces in hotel rooms are light switches and TV remote controls. It was also a good week for Gus Hertz of Roanoke, Virginia, who was vacationing in St. Petersburg, Florida, when he saw a car go over a seawall. Hertz pulled the driver of the submerged car to safety. The next day, Hertz was fishing when an ultralight plane crashed near his boat. I couldn't believe it, he said, after helping rescue the pilot and a passenger. And it was a bad week for preventing voter fraud. After the Miami Herald reported that Florida Governor Rick Scott, who is trying to purge ineligible voters from the state's rolls, had trouble voting in 2006 because voter records showed that he was dead. They let me vote for provisionally, Scott said. I'm sure it counted. And it was a bad week for St. Mary Parish, Louisiana, after its new $3 million Convention and Visitors Bureau sank 5 feet into the ground and cracked like an egg. The building was constructed atop a swamp. And finally, it was a bad week for pitching against your last team. After Tampa Bay Rays reliever Joel Peralta was ejected by umpires for hiding pine tar in his glove, when asked how he knew umps would find the illegal substance on Peltra's glove, Washington Nationals manager Davey Johnson said, "Well, he pitched here." And finally, only in America, Virginia lawmakers had to omit any reference to climate change and sea level rise in funding a study of a growing flooding problem. Scientists say sea levels along the state's coast have risen more than a foot and are still rising. Republicans conceded that flooding is a growing problem, but said there could be no mention of sea level rise because it's a left-wing term. That brings us to the People section, with an article titled, Hagman's Mind-Altering Trip. Psychedelic drugs saved Larry Hagman, said Harry Hurt Ill III in Texas Monthly. In the mid-1960s, the actor suffered a nervous breakdown while filming the TV show I Dream of Jeannie. The crew carted Hagman off to a psychiatrist who suggested he combat his anxiety with LSD. A few days later, Hagman's friend, Peter Fonda, took him to a Crosby, Stills, and Nash concert, where he was handed several tabs of acid by folk rocker David Crosby. Hagman claims that he saw his body's molecular structure during that first trip. Some cells were dying, some were being reborn, says the Dallas Star, 80 years old. I realized we don't disappear when we die. We're always a part of a curtain of energy. That lysergic insight led Hagman to adopt a new motto, don't worry, be happy, feel good. The actor took several more trips, but cannabis slowly became his indulgence of choice. It was fun, and I never had a hangover. When he eventually dies, Hagman says, he wants his body to be ground up and spread over a field and have marijuana and wheat planted and harvest it in a couple of years and make a big marijuana cake. People would eat a little Larry. And that brings us to the briefing section, the space race for tourists. After years of delays, the long-awaited dream of commercial flights to space may soon become reality. Who first proposed space tourism? Pan Am optimistically started offering commercial passenger flights to the moon in 1968, the morning after Apollo 8 became the first manned spacecraft to orbit the moon. Juan Trippe, the airline's founder, established a first moon flights club, whose members could reserve seats on board a commercial moon shuttle that he predicted would launch in the year 2000 at a cost of $14,000 a head. Among the 93,000 people to sign up was then-California Governor Ronald Reagan. Trippe's timing at least wasn't too far off the mark. In April 2001, American businessman Dennis Tito became the first space tourist when he paid $20 million to fly to the International Space Station on a Russian Soyuz spacecraft. Now it finally looks as if a larger-scale passenger flights like into space will soon become a reality. The private company SpaceX last month sent the first commercial shuttle into orbit to rendezvous with the ISS, the most significant step yet in the private sector's race to the stars. Which company will be first? Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic is probably the closest to rocketing day trippers into space, although it keeps pushing back the date. Branson has already signed up over 500 passengers at $200,000 a head for flights on Spaceship Two, A rocket-powered spaceship that will take six paying customers 62 miles above the Earth. At the apex of their flight, they will be able to view the Earth's curvature against the stars and even unbuckle their seatbelts and experience a few minutes of weightlessness. Brent Branson said in November that the first flights would take off sometime in 2012, but that now seems unlikely since Virgin launched the Tourist project in 2004. The date for the maiden flight has been repeatedly delayed. One of Branson's astronauts, venture capitalist Alan Walton, 76, has already asked for his money back, fearing that he will be too old to fly by the time Virgin is ready. "This was a decision I wish I didn't have to make," he said. Why all the delays? Branson's famously optimistic nature has run up against lots of engineering and logistical problems. A fuel tank exploded during tests for Spaceship Two in 2007, killing three engineers, and the construction in New Mexico of Spaceport America, where tourists will take off and land, was plagued with contractor disputes. Competitor Blue Origin, an aerospace company started by Amazon.com founder Jeff Bezos, also suffered a setback when an experimental rocket ship crashed in August 2011 during a high-altitude test. John Gedmark, former executive director of the Commercial Spaceflight Federation, said delays and technical problems were to be expected. "Everything in aerospace always takes longer than you originally think," he said. So is liftoff really imminent? The Federal Aviation Administration thinks so. It said in March that it expected private space vehicles to begin transporting passengers as soon as 2013 and predicted that the industry would be worth $1 billion within 10 years. The FAA plans to roll out detailed safety regulations for space tourists in October 2015. In the meantime, the travel industry is beginning to wake up to opportunities afforded by space tourism. Insurance giant Alliance recently became the first company to offer travel insurance to Virgin Galactic customers in the event that their trip to space is canceled altogether. Delays are not covered. Who else is competing? There are now more companies hoping to make money from spaceflight, at least eight, than there are major U.S. airlines. Bezos' Blue Origin is still testing a suborbital spacecraft similar to Virgin's proposed plane. Armadillo Aerospace, founded by video game designer John Carmack, has promised to fly tourists into space for as little as $102,000, and tickets on XCOR Aerospace Lynx 2-seater will be even cheaper at $95,000. And although SpaceX is focused mostly on contracting for NASA, founder Elon Musk hasn't given up on space tourism completely. Earlier this year, he said he anticipated offering flights to Mars in the next 10 to 15 years. That ticket could cost millions, but price has proved no object for many space tourists. "It's worth every penny," said Guy Laliberté, the Canadian founder of Cirque du Soleil, who paid $35 million for a 12-day trip to the ISS in 2009. "There's so much to learn, so much to discover, so much to look at. How big will space tourism get?" Branson predicts that by 2022, tens of thousands of people will fly into space every year. But many are far less sanguine. Economist Alex Tabarrok has argued that it could take generations for spaceflight to be safe enough for large-scale tourism. He points out that the risk of rocket failure is about 1 in 20, whereas a passenger on a commercial airline has just a 1 in 5 million chance of dying. At best, and for the foreseeable future, space travel will remain akin to climbing Everest. "Dangerous and uncommon," he said. "We might see 100 flights a year, but that's not space tourism. Tourism is fat guys with cameras." You're listening to The Week magazine. Now we'll turn our attention to the section titled Best Columns in the U.S. The first article in this section is entitled Silencing Women on Abortion, and it's written by Jessica Valenti, TheNation.com. Republicans are rolling black women's reproductive rights, and they want to make sure we remain silent as they do it, said Jessica Valenti. Consider the bizarre ban Michigan legislators imposed on State Representative Lisa Brown after she dared to use the word vagina in a debate over a highly restrictive anti-abortion bill, a bill that would close most of the state's abortion clinics and force women to carry horribly deformed fetuses to term. Brown told the male Republicans pushing the bill, "I'm flattered that you're all so interested in my vagina, but no means no." The shocked Republican majority promptly banned Brown from speaking the next day. "The word she used, vagina, was so offensive I don't even want to say it in front of women," said Representative Mike Calton. Apparently, male legislators would rather not be reminded that the vaginas they're attempting to control have pesky women with opinions attached to them. What really offends these men is the idea of women controlling their own bodies and lives. They want us to just shut up already, but we will not shut up. The next article in the best columns in the U.S. is entitled Obama's Boring Speeches. This is written by Alexandra Petri in the WashingtonPost.com. "There are a few moments like the political speech," said Alexandra Petri, "and the highest form of such torture is a politician droning on for close to an hour, as President Obama did last week in his soporific speech on the economy. The president could have easily made his argument that his economic plan is better than Mitt Romney's in a few well-turned sentences. Instead, he rambled on for 54 minutes, almost five times longer than Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, and about 27 times longer than Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. Whatever happened to the gifted orator who gave two of the greatest political speeches of recent decades, his poetic 16-minute speech at the 2004 Democratic National Convention, and his stunningly effective 2008 campaign speech on race? Since then, Obama has succumbed to a strange kind of speech inflation, delivering hundreds of overlong, rambling lectures that leave no impression. Perhaps he should study the Gettysburg Address, which Lincoln delivered in 270 perfectly chosen words. A previous oratory at the Gettysburg banged on for 2 hours and was forgotten. In political speech, less is more." And finally, in this section called Best Columns, the U.S., we see this article titled The Fraud Behind House Hunters. This is by Marcel Friedman, Slate.com. "House Hunters is fake," said Marcel Friedman. "I know. It's hardly shocking news that a reality TV show isn't exactly entirely real. But the HD TV show, which ostensibly shows families shopping for homes until they find their dream, is apparently a total fraud. Former contestant Bobby Jensen revealed last week that her family was filmed only after they had already bought a new home, and the show made her pretend to tour friends' houses that weren't even for sale, at prices divined by its producers. Now, most people know they should view reality TV shows with a chuckle and a grain of salt, but House Hunters isn't merely an escape fantasy like Real Housewives or The Bachelor. The show glorifies the dream of home ownership as an attainable reality, selling the idea that people just like us can, in a few easy steps, find a wonderful house that completes their lives. This is a grave disservice. The same illusion promoted by the show, let us not forget, inflated the housing bubble that led millions of people to default on mortgages they couldn't afford. Our economy has yet to recover." And now the section entitled The Last Word. The Ending No One Wants. "My mother is trapped in a broken body and demented mind," said Michael Wolff. "Is it cruel to keep her alive?" On the way to visit my mother one recent rainy afternoon, I stopped in after quite some constant prodding to see my insurance salesman. He was pressing his efforts to sell me a long-term care policy with a pitch about how much I'd save if I bought it now, before the rates were set to precipitously rise. I am, as my insurance man pointed out, a sweet spot candidate. Not only do I have the cash, though not enough to self-finance my decline, but I also have a realistic view. Like so many people in our 50s, in my experience, almost everybody, I have a parent in an advanced stage of terminal breakdown. It's what my peers talk about, our parents' horror show. From the outside, at the office, restaurants, cocktail parties, we all seem perfectly secure and substantial. But in a room somewhere, hidden from view, we occupy this other, unimaginable life. I don't need to be schooled in the realities of long-term care. The cost for my mother, who is 86, and who for the past 18 months has not been able to walk, talk, or address her most minimal needs, and to boot, is absent a short-term memory, come in at about $17,000 a month. And while her LTC insurance hardly covers all of that, I'm certainly grateful she had the foresight to carry such a policy. And yet, on the verge of writing the first LTC check, I backed up. We make certain assumptions about the necessity of care. It's an individual, and depending on where you stand in the great health care debate, a national responsibility. And yet, I will tell you, what I feel most intensely when I sit by my mother's bed is a crushing sense of guilt for keeping her alive. Who can accept such suffering? Who can so conscientiously facilitate it? In 1990, there were slightly more than 3 million Americans over the age of 85. Now, there are almost 6 million. By 2050, there will be 19 million, approaching 5% of the population. By promoting longevity and technologically inhibiting death, we have created a new biological status held by an ever-growing part of the nation, a no-exit state that persists longer and longer, one that is nearly as remote from life as death, but which, unlike death, requires vast service, indentured servitude, really, and resources. This is not anomalous. This is the norm. Contrary to the comedian's maxim, comedy is easy, dying hard. 70% of those older than 80 have a chronic disability, according to one study. 53% in this group have at least one severe disability, and 36% have moderate to severe cognitive impairments. Alzheimer's is just one form, not as it happens my mother's, of the ever more encompassing conditions of cognitive collapse that are the partners and the price of longevity. There are now more than 5 million demented Americans. By 2050 upward of 15 million of us will have lost our minds. This year the cost of dementia care will be $200 billion. By 2050, $1 trillion. Make no mistake, the purpose of long-term care insurance is to help finance some of the greatest misery and suffering human beings have yet devised. I hesitate to give my mother a personality here. It is the argument I have with myself every day. She is not who she was. Do not force her to endure because of what she once was. Do not sentimentalize, and yet that's the bind. She remains my mother. She graduated from high school in 1942 and went to work for the Paterson Evening News, a daily newspaper in New Jersey, in a newsroom with many of its men off to war. Marguerite van der Werf, nicknamed Van in the newsroom and forevermore, shortly became the paper's military reporter. Her job was to keep track of the local casualties. At 18, a lanky 95 pounds in bobby socks, my mother would often show up at a soldier's parents' front door before the War Department's telegraph and have to tell these souls their son was dead. She married my father, Lou Wolf, an ad man, and left the paper after 11 years to have me, then my sister Nancy, and brother David. She did freelance journalism and part-time PR work, publicity it was called then. She was a restless and compelling personality who became a civic power in our town, got elected to the Board of Education, and took charge of the public library, organizing and raising the money for its new building and expansion. She was the Pied Piper, the charismatic mom, a talker of great wit and passion, holding the attention of children and dinner party drunks alike. My father, whose ad agency had wide swings of fortune, died suddenly in that old-fashioned way of a heart attack at 63, during one of the downswings. My mother was 58, the age I am now, and left with small resources. She applied her charm and guile to a breathtaking reinvention and personal economic revival, becoming a marketing executive at first one and then another pharmaceutical company. At 72, headed to retirement, but still restless, she capped off her career as the marketing head of an online game company. For 25 years, she lived in an apartment building in Ridgewood, New Jersey. Once a week, every week, she drove into Manhattan to cook dinner for my family and help my three children with their homework. I'm not sure how I would have managed my life and raised children without her. This is the woman, or what is left of the woman, who now resides in a studio apartment in one of those new boxy buildings that dot the Upper West Side, a kind of pre-coffin, if you will. It is even, thanks to my sister's diligence, my mother's LTC insurance and savings, and the contributions of my two siblings and me, that we might think of as an ideal place to be in her condition. A painting from 1960 by March Avery from the collection she and my father assembled, an Adirondack chair facing a blue sea, hangs in front of her. Below the painting is a flat-screen TV where she watches cooking shows with a strange intensity. She is attended 24/7 by two daily shifts of devoted caretakers. It is peaceful and serene, except for my mother's disquiet. She stares in a mute reprimand. Her bewilderment and resignation somehow don't mitigate her anger. She often tries to talk, desperate guttural pleas. She strains for cognition and shockingly sometimes bursts forward, reaching it. "Nice suit," she said to me out of the blue a few months ago, before falling back. That is the thing that you begin to terrifyingly appreciate. Dementia is not absence. It is not a non-state. It actually could be a condition of more rather than less feeling, one that, with its lack of clarity and logic, must be a kind of constant nightmare. Old age, says one of Philip Roth's protagonists, isn't a battle. It's a massacre. I'd add, it's a holocaust. Circumstances have conspired to rob the human person of all hope and dignity and comfort. When my mother's diaper is changed, she makes noises of harrowing despair. For a time, before she lost all language, you could, if you concentrated, make out what she was saying, repeat it over and over and over again. "It's a violation, it's a violation, it's a violation." My mother's cardiologist had been for many years monitoring her for a condition called aortic stenosis, a narrowing of the aortic valve. The advice was to do nothing until something had to be done, and now that she was showing symptoms that might suddenly kill her, why not operate and reach for another few good years? What's to lose? My siblings and I must take the blame here. It did not once occur to us to say, "You want to do major heart surgery on an 84-year-old woman showing progressive signs of dementia? What are you, nuts?" Here's what the surgeon said, defending himself in perfect catch-22-ease after the recriminations that followed the stark and dramatic post-operative decline in my mother's quality of life baseline. "I visited your mom before the procedure and fully informed her of the risks of such a surgery to someone showing signs of dementia." You fully inform my demented mom? The operation absolutely repaired my mother's heart. She can live for years, according to the surgeon. But where before she had been gently sinking, now we were in free fall. 6 weeks and something like $250,000 in hospital bills later, paid by Medicare, or that is, by you, she was reduced to a terrified creature, losing language skills by the minute. She certainly appears agitated, the psychiatrist sent to administer antipsychotic drugs told me, and so do you. My sister comes over every morning. She brings the groceries, plans the menu, and has a daily routine for stretching my mother's limbs. I'm here a few times a week, for exactly 30 minutes, no more, no less. Her grandchildren, with an unalloyed combination of devotion and horror, come on a diligent basis. A few weeks ago, my sister and I called a meeting with my mother's doctor. "It's been a year," I began, groping for what needed to be said. "We've seen a series of incremental but marked declines," my sister chimed in with some vivid details. "We just wanted to help her go where she's going." Was that too much? Was that too specific? "She does seem," the doctor allowed, "to have entered another stage, perhaps more palliative care. This can ease her suffering, but the side effect can be to depress her functions. But maybe it's time to err on the side of ease." "Your mom, like a lot of people, is what we call a dwindler," said the doctor. I do not know how death panels ever got such a bad name. Perhaps they should have been called deliverance panels. What I would not do for a fair-minded body to whom I might plead for my mother's end. The alternative is nuts, paying trillions and bankrupting the nation, as well as our souls, as we endure the suffering of our parents and our inability to help them get where they're going. The single greatest pressure on health care is the disproportionate resources devoted to the elderly, to not just the old, but to the old, and yet no one says what all old children of old parents know. This is not just wrong-headed, but steals the life from everyone involved. After due consideration, I decided that I plainly would never want what LTC insurance buys, and, two, that this would be a bad deal. My bet is that even in America, we baby boomers, watching our parents' long and agonizing deaths, won't do this to ourselves. We will surely, we must surely, find a better, cheaper, quicker, kinder way out. Meanwhile, since, like my mother, I can't count on someone putting a pillow over my head, I'll be trying to work out the timing and details of a do-it-yourself exit strategy, as should we all. And that brings us to Talking Points. The first article in that section is entitled, "The GOP, Too Extreme for Reagan?" Jeb Bush is on a quest to push his party away from the political extreme, said Aaron Blake in the Washington Post. The former Florida governor, who is son and brother to the 41st and 43rd presidents, respectively, caused a stir last week by saying that today's GOP has moved so far to the right that neither Ronald Reagan nor his father could be nominated as president. Both Reagan and Bush Sr., he said, were able to solve the nation's problems by compromising and finding some degree of common ground with Democrats in Congress. But today's Republican Party, he said, has an orthodoxy that prevents any political deals on budgets, taxes, or any other issue. Bush was promptly attacked for his apostasy by champions of conservative orthodoxy such as anti-tax campaigner Grover Norquist and former Reagan aide Bruce Bartlett in the Fiscal Times. Norquist called Bush's comments foolish and bizarre, but Jeb is right about Reagan. After he passed a major tax cut and the federal budget deficit ballooned, Reagan supported tax increases and signed 11 of them into law. Reagan also granted amnesty to 3 million illegal immigrants. If Reagan were seeking the Republican nomination today, that record would get him expelled for treason. That's revisionist history, said John Healy in the Los Angeles Times. Reagan was no eager-to-please moderate, but a fiercely partisan conservative whose political mission was to push the GOP to the right. He ultimately succeeded in that mission, but in the 1980s, he had to compromise with liberals on taxes, spending, and other issues in order to govern. Today, with conservatives firmly established, he'd undoubtedly run as the conservative alternative to Mitt Romney. Besides, the evidence contradicts the claim that the GOP has become too rigid and ideological for even the Gipper, said Jonah Goldberg, also in the Los Angeles Times. Look at the crazy right-wingers we've nominated for president recently. The centrist maverick McCain in 2008, and now the Massachusetts moderate Mitt Romney. Any rational person would conclude that Reagan couldn't get elected today because the party has become too liberal. Republican orthodoxy certainly isn't as strict as Bush suggests, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. If it were, the party's nominee this year would be Michelle Bachmann. But Bush is correct that the country can't move forward without some kind of bipartisan agreement in Washington. No matter what Norquist says, addressing the vast structural problems of our indebted government will require both spending cuts and new taxes. Those who rule out the possibility of compromise as a matter of ideology are undermining the public interest. Try telling that to the Kool-Aid drinkers on the far right, said Joseph Sabino Mystic in the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. The fear-mongering extremists now controlling the GOP care about one thing, defeating Obama. Not economic vitality, not job creation, not health care for all Americans. They just want the president to fail. Conservative opposition to Obama is not irrational, said David Brooks in the New York Times. At the heart of the yawning partisan divide is a clash of visions. Obama believes our current system will work fine once he raises taxes on the rich and plows billions of additional dollars into governmental programs supporting education and innovation. But conservatives think the welfare state created in the 20th century is broken. They see what is happening in Europe, cossified economies, collapsing beneath the weight of their entitlements, as proof that the current model is collapsing, and that the U.S. is headed down the same road as Greece and Spain. The only way out, they believe, is an entirely new approach based on conservative free market principles that puts faith in individuals, not government. This isn't extremism or partisan lunacy, it's a viewpoint. In November, we'll find out whether a majority of voters want to sign on to that viewpoint, said Jonathan Shate, NewYorkMagazine.com. If Republicans lose to the hated Obama again, they will have to do some soul-searching and admit that their harsh partisan rhetoric turned off voters. The party may finally see the wisdom of embracing moderation and compromise on issues like taxes and immigration, especially since Latinos have become a pivotal voting bloc in presidential elections. At that point, the party will be casting about for somebody to lead it. How about Jeb Bush, who has not only called for more compromise, but who speaks fluent Spanish and has a Mexican-American wife? In taking on the ideologies last week, Bush was clearly positioning himself as the next leader of the Republican Party. The final Talking Points article is entitled, Lance Armstrong, Just Another Cheater? Lance Armstrong may have a couple more mountains to climb, said Bill Saporito in Time.com. The U.S. Anti-Doping Agency has accused the legendary cyclist, now 40 years old, of using the banned substance, EPO, and giving himself blood transfusions during his record-setting 7 victories in the Tour de France. If Armstrong can't prove his innocence, he'll be stripped of those 7 titles. Many of us simply do not want to hear that Lance Armstrong cheated to win, said Rich Carlgaard in Forbes.com. He became a national folk hero by first beating cancer, which had ravaged his body and left him near death, and then going on to dominate the most demanding endurance competition in the world. But 10 of Armstrong's teammates are claiming first-hand knowledge of his doping, and during the years he blew another top cyclist away on mountain climbs, they were all doping. For Armstrong to overcome the 5% performance advantage that doping confers would be virtually impossible. What's the point of ruining this guy, said Matt Seaton in Guardian.co.uk. The USADA has no stone-cold proof that Armstrong cheated and is merely saying that more sophisticated current tests of samples deemed clean at the time are consistent with EPO use and blood transfusions. A federal prosecutor just spent 2 years trying to indict Armstrong based on the same evidence and decided in February not to file charges. We don't know whether Armstrong doped, said Buzz Bissinger in the DailyBeast.com, but almost every other star of Armstrong's era went on to be exposed as a doper. Armstrong beat them all, so even if he was breaking the rules himself, at least the playing field was even. Not true, said Bill Gifford in Slate.com. Not everyone said yes to the proffered syringe, and many young cyclists in Armstrong's era who refused to cheat were denied the chance to compete at the very highest level. We owe it to them and to cycling itself to finally learn the truth about one of the most storied records in sports. Thanks to more stringent testing, cycling is much cleaner than in Armstrong's day, said John Lester in Associated Press. But for everyone to believe in this beautiful sport again, with human beings pushing themselves to the limit against the backdrop of mountains, the dirty past needs to be exposed and then deleted. Go away, Lance. Make way for a cleaner future. And under the section titled Noted, in this talking points section of the magazine, we see the following two paragraphs. The average member of the House of Representatives has to raise $367 for every hour they're supposedly serving their constituents to pay for their re-election campaigns. The average senator needs to wrangle $819 per hour. That's from Mother Jones. And from BBC.com, we see this noted article. Taken cumulatively, the world population is 16.5 million tons overweight, with Americans easily topping the scales. If everyone on the planet had the same average weight as Americans, it would be equivalent to having 935 million additional people on Earth. And under Wit and Wisdom, we see the following two entries. The first one from Bill Cosby, quoted in the Charlotte, North Carolina Observer. Parents are not interested in justice. They're interested in peace and quiet. And then from Robert Louis Stevenson, quoted in HuffingtonPost.com, we see, to be what we are and to become what we are capable of becoming is the only end of life. And in Poll Watch, we see the following. First one from Monmouth University poll, CNN.com. 67% of Americans support the use of unmanned drone aircraft to track down criminals. But 67% would oppose the use of drones to issue tickets to highway speeders. 64% say they fear losing their privacy if law enforcement agencies begin routinely using drones with high-tech cameras. And from The Hill, Pulse Opinion Research, we see the following Poll Watch statistic. 75% of Americans say they're worried the country will soon fall into another recession. And under the Health and Science section of this magazine, we see the following. A plus for old dads. The older men are when they have children, the more likely those children are to inherit a genetic boost that will help them live a long life. A new study shows that as men age, their sperm develop longer telomeres, the genetic material at the tips of chromosomes that help protect against cell damage. Those longer telomeres, which are linked to slower cell aging and a decreased risk of diseases like cancer, are passed directly on to a man's children and continue to show up even in his grandchildren. This happens across at least two generations, Northwestern's university anthropologist Dan Eisenberg tells Time.com. The telomeres in sperm develop in the opposite way to telomeres in the rest of the body, which shorten with age and can be stunted by environmental stress, such as exposure to violence during childhood. But while older fathers do offer a longevity advantage, previous research has shown that they're also more likely to father children with a genetic predisposition to autism, schizophrenia, and bipolar disorder. And this article, titled A World with More Hellish Wildfires. The monster forest fires rampaging across the western states may soon be the norm, thanks to climate change. New research indicates that as rainfall diminishes and vegetation dries out on a warmer planet, the West is headed into a more fire-prone future. Wildlife specialist Max Moritz tells the Los Angeles Times, after studying satellite imaging of fires and data from 16 climate models, Moritz and other researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, found that rising temperatures are likely to change fire patterns not just in the western U.S., but across 80% of the planet by the end of the century. Polar and temperature regions, including tundras and hardwood forest and grasslands, will become drier and more vulnerable to fire, while some desert regions could experience extra rainfall, promoting bigger plants that will give flames more fuel. These abrupt changes in fire patterns will affect people who live in or near the drier regions and add stress to native plants and animals that are already struggling to adapt to habitat loss, Moritz says. In the long run, we found that what we most fear, increasing fire activity across large areas of the planet. And finally, health scare of the week, radiation from medical scans. Patients are getting larger and perhaps even dangerous doses of radiation from the growing number of advanced medical imaging tests being ordered by doctors, a new study says. They found that the number of patients who underwent CT scans tripled to more than 1 in 10 recently, and the number of those who received dangerous doses of radiation from the scans doubled. A recent study found that children who had multiple CT scans, often to diagnose minor fractures or infections, were 3 times as likely to develop brain tumors or leukemia later in life as children exposed to less radiation. While CT scans can be a valuable tool for assessing internal injuries, study author Rebecca Smith-Beinman tells the New York Times, we need to minimize unnecessary exposures wherever possible. Many physicians use the test to rule out undiagnosed problems and to safeguard against malpractice lawsuits. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, filling in for George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. Content of this program intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Broadcast available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please don't hesitate to contact us, 919-832-5138. So long. Until next time.